Hey everybody, Alan Arnett here with another podcast and the blog on alanarnett.com. It is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024, and look who is at the top of your screen, Steve House. Hey, Steve.
Hi, Alan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well here in Colorado. How's the weather in Austria?
Yeah, it's spring-like. We're getting alternating rain and snow and sunshine, so it's very spring.
Spring in the Alps, or now are you technically in the Alps or in the Dolomites?
Yeah, technically on the north end of the Dolomites.
Okay, yeah,
I can
cool.
see the northernmost peak of the Dolomites from my window as I'm sitting here.
Tough view, man.
Tough life, somebody
Now,
has to do
you
it.
traded the San Juan Range in southern Colorado for the Dolomites in Austria. You know how to do that. Hey, let me just introduce you for our readers or viewers and listeners that don't know you, which would be very few. But Steve, of course, is one of the climbing industry's most premier and skilled athletes. He was a professional climber for 21 years. He guided, he climbed all over the world. He won a lot of prestigious awards. He opened up new routes. He founded a business, and in all that time, he also had found time to have two boys and just a lot of other things. And we're gonna cherry pick some of these things as we go through them. But let's just start with so were you one of these dirtbag climbers, Steve, back in the day, living out of your car, just as Fred Beckley would hold up the sign, "We'll belay for food."
We'll belay for food. Yeah, I didn't have to. I think I might have belayed Fred Becky for food once, but I did go to college and finish a degree, undergraduate degree. I actually wanted to be an astronaut, so I tried to go into aeronautical engineering, but then ended up kind of had the climbing bug so bad that I just didn't want to work that hard. So I got a job as an apprentice mountain guide for American Alpine Institute when I was the ripe old age of 20, and that really changed the course of my life because I was able to, guide in the summers and winters and then climb in the springs and falls. And that was the routine, that was the schedule for the next like roughly 15 years.
When you think back on it, what was it about climbing that that touched you, that caused you to kind of fall in love with it?
I have a theory that, that the climbing is in your genes. And if you have the climbing gene and you get exposed to climbing, that switch flips and your life is just altered. And if you don't have it, you can be exposed to climbing and nothing happens, right? Like I think it's sort of like that. And for me, I started climbing with my dad actually when I was a young kid. My dad had gotten into climbing through a barracks mate when he was in the army stationed in Germany back in the 1960s. And so when he returned to the US, he continued to climb, and he introduced me to rock climbing and mountaineering. And it was always just sort of this really special thing that he and I did. We would go on these little weekend trips, and I have a sister, and she wasn't that interested, so it was sort of dad and me, and it was this really cool thing. And we would have the campfire, and we'd get to camp out, and for me to have one-on-one time with my dad, I was just, that was the best thing, right? So
That's great.
I think that had a lot to do with, me falling in love with climbing. And then I had a really great group of friends in growing up, and they eventually all got into climbing too. And so I had this little posse of about 10 friends that I grew up with and who I'm still very close with, incredible friends, lifelong friends. And we all started rock climbing and skiing together. And then, of course, when we got to college age, we all went different directions. And it was still that thing that was consistent in my life, I think, when I was going through that transition from, adolescence to adulthood. And, I figured out that I could take that knowledge and skills that I had and at least get started on a career in guiding. And, that would give me, the financial basis, albeit it wasn't much, but, it was enough. I had modest means, and I did live in a 1976 red Mazda pickup with a with a camper on the back for about 8 years when I wasn't guiding. And then when I was guiding, it was either in a rented room that we shared for the summers, or I was in Ecuador or someplace and just living off the guide service, basically. So long story short, but I don't know, you know, it's all you know, it's been climbing in the mountains have just been a very consistent thing in my throughout my entire life.
And one of the things that that I find really interesting is that you chose primarily very difficult, many times first ascents of rock climbs at significant altitude, but you never did any other than, I guess, Nanga Parbat. Is that the only 8,000er that you've done?
I climbed Cho Oyu as well. Okay. I climbed Cho Oyu. You know, I went over there with, you know, attached to a guided group through IMG, was running the trip, and I'm known Eric Simonson taught one of the first avalanche classes I ever took when I was a kid at Crystal Mountain. And so Eric organized that I could go along and climb on my own, but be on their permit and use their base camp and stuff. And yeah, I had not been above 7,000 meters at that point. So I just wanted, like, okay, I want to do this, but I better make sure I can. And yeah, so, and then I focused pretty hard on Nanga Parbat for the next few years. Cause that was a very specific goal, climbing the RuPaul face.
Because you, that you didn't take the normal route either. So, right.
Yeah, there was, like, I think in, you know, in alpinism, there's sort of always the quote unquote last great problems, you know, and it changes for every generation. And, you know, for me, at least, it was the central pillar of the RuPaul face was the great problem to do. You know, that was like the number one objective, that if you could only do one thing, that would be the thing.
And you never did any, so you did two of the 14. Did just kind of going through that list, did that just not interest you, or was there more interesting climbs on your book?
I actually went to Makalu three different times and tried to climb a new route on the west face of Makalu, but didn't ever. I got pretty high on the normal route, not to summit on the normal route, but we would, you know, when you think about these things, like, let's just back up for a second. After I climbed Nanga Parbat, I said, okay, I want to do a new route on the west face of Makalu, and I want to do a new route on the west face of K2. Those are the other two big prizes. And, you know, one of the things I learned I spent a lot of time climbing in the Alaska range, and I did a lot. I did three new routes on Denali, for example. And one of the keys to my, you know, us being successful on those routes was the layout of the mountain. And so Makalu is really well laid out for climbing a new route on the west face, because you get to the summit, you can go down the normal route. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you just climb the west face, then the normal route is relatively easy. Same thing with K2. If you get to the summit, you can go down the Abruzzi. So, you know, not that those are easier cakewalks, but they are in the realm of, like, what is regularly done. So those were both on my radar. I never did attempt K2. I had the permit and I had everything paid for in 2010 when I had an accident. I was actually going there with Uli Steck in 2010, and we had the permit, we had all the money raised, and we were going there to attempt the West Face Couloir that season. But I had a bad accident, and then that cut short, changed my plans.
That was pretty well chronicled, that accident that you had. So that leads me to the question of risk and reward and risk tolerance. How do you, I mean, some of the climbs that you've done are just incredible in terms of the objective danger and the risk associated with it. Would you put yourself in the same category as, like, a Honnold, where, you know, you have a flat line of emotions there? Or how did you learn how to manage that adrenaline, that danger, relative to trying to accomplish these very, very ambitious goals?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that a lot of what we, and I say we in the sense of climbers and alpinists, have done. Climbing without a rope, for example, is just one of the tools in the tool belt of an accomplished alpinist and a confident alpinist. That's not to say it's easy to make judgments about, like, oh, it's bad, or they're being reckless, or something like that. I think it is it arguably is reckless if you're putting other people at risk. But when you're not, when it's only you that you're putting at risk, and you're in some remote valley of the Karakoram, there's not going to be a rescue, let alone a body recovery or anything. You're just going to disappear. So you're arguably not putting anyone at risk. But back to your question, I think that what Alex has done such a wonderful job of bringing to the masses, I would say, is this idea that we can mentally, overcome what, by all, accounts and by all observations, should be a complete panic situation, right? Like, you're standing on 2,000 feet off of the ground on a edge the size of a dime and have your one hand stuck in a crack. Like, by any measure, that should be like just full on panic and we would all die, right? But and if you took an unacclimated, untrained Alex Honnold and put him in that position, he would react the same way. But it's these what people are capable, what I hope people see in that and see in what alpinists have done is that, through a long process of sort of dedicated to a craft, you can become so comfortable. And I don't want to say confident because that sounds like it sounds like hubris a little bit, but you can become good enough at knowing where your limit is that you can, not with 100% certainty, but with near 100% certainty, say, I can do this and this is going to be okay. And I sort of sometimes use the analogy of, like, driving down the freeway at 70 miles an hour and there's or driving on a two-lane highway at 60 miles an hour and there's cars going the opposite direction at 60 miles an hour. Why do we think that that's safe when we know, like, if somebody looks down and picks up their phone off the floor at the wrong moment, they'll swerve into your lane and everybody's gonna die. But we're so confident that our cars and that we are capable of just staying in our lane and going down the road. And it's a little bit like that. Like, you're just so confident that you can climb this, then you can stay on. Like, when you watch those videos of Alex climbing, and I don't have any videos really of me soloing any big alpine objectives, and the videos I do have of soloing were quite staged, with one exception, they were quite staged. And so you see that people are completely relaxed. And the reason I say that staged is because I always said, like, I'm not soloing for the camera, because if I ever, because unless the camera is incidentally there, I'm climbing without the rope for myself and for my own internal motivations and my internal journey. But if I have to do it or feel any, or if there's external pressure at all, that's not the right reason, and I won't do it for that reason.
Have you on those attempts that you did not make the summit, did you turn around because of danger or conditions?
On K7 specifically, or when, which one? lots of failed.
Let's go with Bakalu on that one.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've probably turned around for every reason there is, right? From, at some time or another, whether, bad feeling in my gut to bad weather to altitude illness to food illness to head cold to, lots of things, dropped equipment, destroyed equipment. Partner that wasn't motivated, I wasn't motivated. I think I've turned around for all the reasons. And I think that's actually, like, something really interesting about mountaineering, Alan, that I really love. I think it's like, I see, I played Little League when I was a kid. I don't know if you did, but like when I played Little League and I was a little kid, I hated it when we lost. Like, I would cry and I would throw a tantrum and all that stuff. And I think turning around and mountaineering is sort of the equivalent of losing in middle and in Little League. And if you can't see the better part of that process and of, that you don't win every time, then I think, that's telling you something that you've got some work to do on your motivations, what you're really there for.
Yeah, I think that, I tried Everest 3 times and didn't make it. And every time, the first 2 times I came home feeling like, oh my gosh, it's all on me. I did not prepare well enough. It was my fault. And so that really dug at me, just hit me really hard. The third time, I mean, I was going too slow, and I came home utterly defeated and ready to give up and never go again. But then, to your point, there's something that digs at you and still talks to you. I often tell people that, and you mentioned this at the very beginning, that climbing, if you love it, it becomes this expensive addiction for which there is no cure. And if
100%.
you hate it, then you'll never do it again. So we all of us end up being these climbing addicts. And again, I think that we learn a lot though from those. I don't call them failures. I always call them non-summits. So.
I think that's a great way to look at it. I think that there's so much wisdom in what you're saying, and I think that that's part of the gift of mountaineering is the failure and or the non-summit. And because you'll have that voice, I'm going to name it, at least for me, it's like when I've come back and I felt like I was the reason we failed. It was the what I call the inner critic, right? And then it's like, well, wait a second, who is this inner critic, and where are they speaking from, and why do they have any authority over me, and why do I believe them? And it starts you start to like it's like this self, it's like you're doing therapy on yourself a little bit.
Yourself, yeah.
It's and you if you start asking those questions, and for me, one of the things that I don't know about you, Alan, but like I never keep a journal or a diary in normal life, but every time I'm on an expedition, I religiously journal. It just feels like part of the process every night is sort of winding down, and maybe not every night, but a couple times a week at least, to just sort of write down what happened. Like I always have like these little weather like diary. I'll write down what the weather it was every day, what the clouds were, what the wind was doing, what the pressure was. Part of my sort of keeping track of the conditions. But then I'm also like reflecting and thinking and feeling, and it's I think a really healthy process.
Yeah, I mean that's you hit the nail on the head about why I blogged when I climbed. I originally started and I when I guess it was on Troy OU, one of my first big climbs. I still have the notebook where I journaled everything, and then the internet came along, so then I started to post new daily post of what happened that day, and it really was more of a reflection about what I was feeling, and I think that's what people actually liked because I didn't try to be anything that I wasn't. If I got diarrhea and pooped in my pants or missed an anchor or whatever, then I just called it like it is. And I think it's that humility, but the process of documenting it. And I still go back now, 20 years later and read stuff that I wrote a long time ago. And it's a wonderful way of reliving it, without boring people to death.
Well, and I mean, I think that that's not the humility as much as for me, there's certainly humility is a role, but the humanity of it, because everyone can relate to you being human up there and struggling and suffering and pooping your pants or like making mistakes or doing all the things that we've all done at high altitude. I mean, it's a unique kind of torture being up above 7,000 meters. It's really something special, and things just until you've done it, it's hard to explain to people what it's actually like. And, that's, I think that's where our society is right now. We sort of still, of course, have this sort of hero worship, like the Kardashians or what Tom Brady is doing, or I don't know what, but there's a lot of interest in just these. I think that's reality TV. It's social media. It's, you know, what are people who are struggling to do hard things going through? Because we all aspire to do hard things. I think that, or maybe not all, but most of us aspire to do challenging things of one form or another. And I think that a lot of people also are just interested in hearing and reading about people going through hard things. I mean, look at, like, you know, my sister's favorite podcast are these unsolved murders and stuff like that, you know, and I was asking her about it. She was saying that it's not the murder that's interesting. It's like why people haven't been able to solve it. And the continuing attempts to try to find some new evidence or clues or see it from a different things, events from a different angle. Like it's the process of trying to solve it that's interesting to her. And her thinking like maybe she would come up with an insight that would lead to the discovery of the truth and lead to a conviction or something like that, right? Like that's what's going on in her mind. I think that's so interesting. Like we love to live vicariously through others, and we want to relate to those we live vicariously through.
Well said. So when you look to some of these projects, and maybe we can use two as an example, the Iger North Face, and then the Rupal on Nanga Parbat, you climbed a lot of this before tools like Google Earth was out there. And, so how did you go about researching the route and, you know, figuring out what was the right way to do it? Was it through word of mouth, talking to people, or just standing at the bottom of it, looking up?
Great question. All the things. So I think one of the record of all these kinds of attempts and climbs is the American Alpine Journal. So that's sort of the starting point, and figure out who did what, when, because even the non-summits of the west face of Mach Liu are recorded there. It might only be a paragraph or a few sentences, but it'll be like, so-and-so and I went there and we got this high and we turned around, and then you have their name, and then you can like use Google or whatever, or you can get a hold of the Club Alpine Français and say, hey, I'm looking for this guy. I want to ask him about his attempt on Mach Liu in 1984. Do you have his email or phone number? And more often than not, people will, if you go out and search for stuff, people will help to bend over backwards to help you. And so that's the starting point. And one of the things I always ask for is photos, because, as old as climbing is, you know, photography has been a big part of that. And a lot of climbers bring quality glass and quality cameras up to all kinds of places. And you'd be amazed at what slides are lurking in people's, garage and stuff. And it's like, oh, wow. Like, well, yeah, I have these pictures. We didn't do the climb, but we did do this acclimatization peak over across the valley, and I got some really great pictures with this telephoto lens on a Nikon, you know, F4, and it's on Velvia, and I'll send you the slides and you can scan. I mean, like, I'm not making that up. Those are the kinds of things that would happen. With Nanga Parbat specifically, I found a guy who had been on assignment for National
in Pakistan, and he is a Slovenian guy, and he knew a Slovenian climber that I knew, and this Slovenian climber I knew had knew that I was trying to find pictures, and he got a hold of this guy, and this guy, not a climber, but he had been in the area, and he had been there with his professional grade equipment and a tripod, and he had a really clear morning one morning, and he made zoomed, like, I can't remember, it was like 16 or 24, like, zoom images of the Rupal face from the opposite side of the valley. And I printed them out as big as I could, and they covered my whole living room floor. And I taped them together, and I had this, like, you know, I had to roll it up, you know, and I had this huge thing, and I started plotting, you know, the map. With that route, it's really not that complicated because there's really only one way to go that is not objectively dangerous from Serax. There's so many Serax on that face. So there's a pillar in the middle of the face that leads basically to the summit. And that was known. It was more about the details of like how you get on the pillar, where do you actually climb when you're on this, because the thing is basically 5,000 meters high. So it's basically five L caps. So, you know, you've got 15,000 feet, a little more of technical climbing ground, and it starts at 11,000 feet and ends at 26,000 feet. So it's just, I mean, I like to say those statistics because people, you've been to the Himalayan, you've walked up the Baltoro and all these amazing places, and you know, you can honestly say that if people have never been there, they can't really understand the scale of mountains. I mean, you must have seen Nanga Parbat either from the Karakoram Highway or from, and you know, you're standing there at the Karakoram Highway. I mean, you're at like whatever, like 4,000 or 5,000 feet, and you're looking at a 26,000 foot summit.
Yeah,
and it doesn't even feel real, right? It just feels like you're looking at a cloud or something. It's like, that can't be a mountain.
That's crazy. Oh, wow. So you were sponsored by a lot of big name companies. Patagonia, you were an ambassador for them for a long time, and I don't know, maybe six, mm-hmm. eight different companies. And then one day you kind of just said, well, that's it. And I don't know if you left those sponsorships or those relationships at the same time that you retired from the sport, but kind of talk us through that transitional time. What was it that caused you to say, you know, I've had a good run and I'm not going to do that anymore?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was definitely a process. It was not just, I mean, I think from the outside, it seemed like a moment, but yeah. For me, it was a long multi-year process. And, you know, I had a really serious climbing accident in 2010. In 2011, I went back to the Himalaya and made my first or second attempt on Mach Talu. Went one more time, did some other climbing in Peru. And, you know, the reality was that, you know, my body just wasn't going to be able to do, after a couple of years, had to admit, like, you know, I was 40 at the time I was injured, and I had to admit, like, I was just never going to be regain the level physically of fitness that I had before that accident. It just wasn't going to happen. My body had changed too much as a result of that accident. And I broke, you know, I had ribs that were completely shattered. I had, you know, all kinds of internal injuries. I broke my pelvis in two places. I had a collapsed lung. You know, when I went back a year later to thank the rescue team, I met the ER doc, and he's like, oh yeah, I remember you. Yeah, your trachea was over by your left ear. Yeah, we usually don't see that in live people.
Oh.
It took me a day to process what he meant. I was like, oh, he meant he usually sees that in dead people. Okay, I got it. So, you know, I was extremely lucky. I was extremely injured. And I think part of the shock of that was not admitting to myself for a few years. My whole identity was being is the best alpinist I could be. That was my life's mission statement. Everything had to go through that filter. I want to be the best alpinist I can be. Everything, relationships, money, you know, sponsorship contracts. If it didn't move me to that goal, then I wasn't doing it. It was just that simple. And so when I realized that I couldn't really, the best I could be wasn't as good as I had been, I felt like that was tough. At the same time, you know, as a sort of project, to keep myself busy during the recovery, you know, process, you know, I wrote the training for the new alpinism book with Scott Johnston, and that, you know, we honestly thought that was going to be, initially we thought it was going to be 100 pages and we would print off 100 or 200 copies and give them away to 100, 200 people that actually cared about it, and our lives would go on. And there, yeah. And now you just pulled it off your desk and showed it to me. And, you know, that
Bible book,
you know, it really changed, I think, the course of my life in a positive way. You know, we, in, you know, that I don't remember what year it came out now, but I think it was 2015 and 2016. By that, a year later, we had basically been kind of almost forced by the number, sheer number of requests to start a company, Uphill Athlete. We started offering coaching. We started writing training plans and selling those online. We started writing more on the website. We continued to develop how we communicated, and our communication skills improved a lot, actually, just from, you know, writing and talking about it every day for years. Yeah. And I also at the same time started to see an opportunity, you know, of another way I could help I started to see an opportunity for a way to make some meaning out of my experiences. Because I think for me at that time, as I looked to the, you know, there's, okay, I think it's also important to say, put this in context, there's no history of professional climbing ahead of me. I mean, I think my sort of mentor would be Conrad Anker, right? Like, he's about 10 years older than me, and he is a little bit ahead of me on that curve, and had gone through a long and wonderful career as an athlete for the North Face and others. But Patagonia, you know, it's an amazing company, and I really believed in their mission, and I was really excited about that. But it also felt like, you know, they didn't, you know, I'm going to take this all with a grain of salt, but what I'm going to say, and this is the North Face runs what I would call a classical sports marketing playbook, right? They kind of, and Patagonia's marketing playbook is much different. They have a different mission statement. They have a different focus, and that's great. And as brand ambassadors, we were always there to be an ambassador between the communities that we serve and represent and the brand for what the trends are, what's happening, what people want in terms of their clothing and equipment, as well as develop clothing and equipment and test clothing and equipment and all of that. So as I was not really able to climb at a super high level anymore, I felt like my role there was not as important. And I didn't really have a clear, let's say, path in front of me in terms of like what my neck, you know, end of career or last 15 years of a career would look like. And there I was, you know, just turning 50, and Uphill Athlete had turned into a meaningful business. And I thought, you know, I think this could be even better if I could focus on Uphill Athlete the way I focused on my climbing. And I'm a person that does not do multiple things well at once. And I think the only reason I achieved any success in climbing is because I was completely 100% focused on it. Yeah. Yep. And so that was kind of the decision over a long period of time, kind of a combination of not seeing a clear like runway for the next 15 years of, you know, I have to earn, I don't have a trust fund. I have to have a paycheck. Didn't see a clear path in that way, as my climbing was not, you know, on let's say professional standard anymore. And there was this way to take what I'd learned through training and training for climbing and transition into a business that was working. And it was a proven, I was like, okay, that works. I can see how that works. And I think that if I focus on it, I could make it even better and I could help a lot of people. And so that was ultimately the decision. And that was 4 years ago, 3 years ago now.
Yeah. I didn't realize that the book came first. I thought that Uphill came first and then you guys wrote this book. But, you know, this really is the modern day Freedom of the Hills, in my opinion. And, you know, I know so many people have read it. It's also a PhD thesis So it's pretty incredible. There's a lot of information in it.
Yeah, it took us 3 years to write.
Wow.
And you know, not working on it every day full time, but yeah, and that it did come out before Uphill Athlete started. The training for the Uphill Athlete book came out after Uphill Athlete was started. And that was definitely a more calculated, like, okay, we're getting a lot of trail runners. We don't have any credibility in the trail running space. We could take this training for the New Alpinism book and sort of rewrite it for trail running. And, you know, the fundamental principles are all the same. We're better communicators. We're better at explaining how all this stuff works and better writers. So that was definitely more of a calculated decision to do that, to help the business.
So Uphill really became your way of tangibly giving back, and of all the wisdom and the experience that you've learned. And I've kind of done something similar with my little Summit Coach business, because, you know, I'm going to turn 68 in, you know, in July. I can't believe that still, but you know, I have all this experience that I have, and I think not to give back and to help people accomplish their dreams is almost selfish. And so I know that with Uphill, that let's get into a little more detail on it. So how big is the organization and how many people you think you've helped thus far? And do you have a mission statement? This is business.
The mission statement is to educate and inspire all mountain athletes through education. And so I view everything we do as education, whether it's, you know, like any company now, we deliver us our core service, which of course is coaching athletes one-on-one. We have a group coaching program, and then we have training plans, and, you know, all of that is education to me. Like a good coach is educating their athlete to the point where the athlete eventually doesn't really need them anymore. Right. And that's the normal progression, right? The passing on, they just of the wisdom and been through enough circumstances and made enough adjustments and enough plannings to get to that point. And, you know, but we're also a media company. You know, we're writing blog posts, we're producing a podcast. You know, those are the low cost ways of disseminating information. And, you know, I think that's also, you know, even though I categorize it from a business point of view as marketing, it's really fulfilling our mission of education. Mm-hmm. And because I want people to, I always think of the 24-year-old Steve living in that Mazda pickup who might not have even had $35 to buy a book and would have gotten a library card and gone and read every article on the website and figured out a training plan and improved his climbing that way. And so that person, that avatar, is still really important to me.
And Uphill, a lot of people, I think of it more of for climbers, but you do everybody, you know, marathoners and runners, skiers.
We're even getting into, we have two coaches who coach quite a few mountain bikers, which is a little bit outside. But again, like, you know, any endurance sport, you know, a good endurance coach can probably figure out. And if you have a coach, like, you know, we have one of our coaches, Zoe Nance. I mean, I don't know how many times she's completed and placed in her category in the Leadville 100 mountain bike race. I mean, it's like something like over 20 finishes or something like that. She's got a lifetime. She's almost 60 years old. She's been doing this sport as long as it's been a sport. She takes that with her career as an endurance coach for 28 years. I mean, a woman like that, a coach like that can coach someone for Everest and turn around and coach someone for, you know, a 200-mile ultra and turn around and coach them for someone for an adventure race. And like, cause you're taking the same basic principles and just reinterpreting them for different final applications. But the basics of the human physiology are universal. So we do a lot of athletes. We have, I think we're in total on the payroll is 24 people.
Cool. It's a great business. And part of that payroll, part of that, your coaching are nutritionists. You offer nutritional coaching.
dietitian specifically. Yeah.
I kind of talk a little bit about, I don't know, this is a great question or a stupid question or an obvious question, but talk about how nutrition plays a role in these endurance sports, be it a marathon or, you know, climbing Everest or whatever.
It's super important. And this is one of the things that, you know, those that are our fans are watching a Pilathlete will see over the next year as we're going to evolve more in the direction of supporting the whole athlete. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, it kind of comes from the model of, you know, if you have an Olympic ski racer, they're going to have a coach, but they're also going to have a dietitian. They're going to have a massage therapist. They're going to have a physical therapist. They're going to have a strength training coach. They're going to have like a whole team around them. They're going to have a mindset coach. So we've already introduced mindset coaching. That's proving to be really popular. We have the dietitians that do the nutrition coaching. We're doing altitude coaching for the people's using the hypoxico tents to sleep in and help with their pre-acclimatization. So trying to really fill in all the supporting things for athletes, because, you know, as you know, the one thing we won't do is we won't teach people how to hold their ice axe or use their crampons, right? Like that, there's a whole world of excellent mountain guides out there that we'll do that and specialize on that. That's, we're not going to ever do that. Even though I have a background as a mountain guide, that's nothing that we're going to do as uphill athlete, but everything else I think that we can support. And so the nutrition, you know, it can either support, but bad nutrition can also undermine your training. And it's important. There's so much information and frankly misinformation out there around nutrition, because everyone's a sample of one, and they can all do say, oh, I did this and it worked great for me and blah, blah, blah. So everybody should do that. And it's important that people get the support that they need. And I have to say, it's a little bit like endurance training. The basics of it are pretty boring. It's like there are no silver, just like with endurance training, there are no silver bullets. The silver bullet is getting the basics right.
I know that's the silver bullet. 24-week program that you have. I've had clients go through that and they'll say, you know, I don't find it hard enough. And I don't think I'm working hard enough. And you and I have talked about this before. And so why do you think people feel that way? Because it goes exactly what you just said about is boring.
Yeah. It's a great question. And it's a common reaction, right? And the reason is that I think that people think of training when they think of the Rocky movies. They think that it should look like, you know, Sylvester Stallone, like having somebody punch him in the stomach while he does sit-ups, or, you know, run until he throws up, or, you know, and the reality is with endurance, and that combined with the strength training model that we all have in our minds, where if we all intuitively know that if we do a biceps curl with 1 pound, and then tomorrow we do it with 2 pounds, and then the next day we do it, and we slowly increase the weight over time, the muscle will develop. We'll see it develop. We'll see it actually get our bicep get bigger. We'll see the muscle tone improving. We'll have like visible results, and we'll be able to go from 1 pound up to, I don't know, 80 pounds or 100 pounds or whatever that is. There's some up, obviously there's a absolute physical limit. But endurance training doesn't really work that way. Endurance training is about getting your body into zone two, into sort of a moderate, you know, level of endurance exercise. But think of that as a pace that you can maintain for an hour without killing yourself. And, or another way to think of it is, I tell people, like, think of it as a pace where if you're with a friend, you can maintain a conversation. Right. And, you know, there's lots of ways to, you know, kind of do this. We have tests, we call the aerobic threshold test, where we put athletes through, and then we use a software tool called Training Peaks to analyze that test and figure out exactly where their training heart rate training zone should be. That's the fine point of it. But the macro of it is that it doesn't really feel that hard, because you're just trying to put your body into that state every day for a longer, slowly longer and longer and longer period of time. And what's changing isn't the muscle tone or the size of your quadriceps or the size of your glutes. They may actually get smaller. What's changing is your metabolism. Yep. Endurance is a metabolic property. It's much more than, because it's this whole chain of taking the food that goes in your mouth and the water that goes in your mouth and turning that into forward motion. And there's about a gazillion steps in between those things. And the way you do, you tell your body you need to be able to do that is by doing it on a really consistent basis. And it's really important for high altitude mountaineers because all of this happens, yeah, all this metabolism happens aerobically in the presence of oxygen. It's not a, it's not important to train hill sprints for climbing Mount Everest because you're never going to do a hill sprint. You're never going to sprint on Mount Everest. I mean, hopefully not, unless there's a terrible situation. But in that case, you've got adrenaline to help you through those 10 seconds. But what you are going to do is you're going to be carrying a pack and wearing boots and crampons and a bunch of heavy equipment for hours and hours at a day, time. You're going to get to a camp that's going to be uncomfortable. You're going to be underfed. You're going to be underwatered. You're going to be underslept, underrecovered. And you're going to have to get up and do another 12-hour day the next day. And you're going to repeat that for at least three or four times. And that's what mountaineering is. And so the better your metabolism is, the better your metabolism can handle prolonged aerobic activity without getting fatigued, the better you can be on summit day. Because it's all about how you feel on summit day. It's not how you feel on the day you go to camp one. It's how you feel on the last day. That's what counts.
I remember reading on your forum, this is a couple of years ago, where somebody was asking about, so I'm going to go climb, you know, whatever it's going to be, you know, Rainier or Everest or something. And they said, and I really like swimming. So I want to go, you know, I'm going to train by swimming only. And the answer on the forum was, if you're a swimmer, swim for training. If you're a runner, run for training. And if you're a climber, climb for training. Is that still the adage today?
Absolutely. You know, in coaches call it the principle of specificity. You know, we'll prescribe with a swimmer, if I'm coaching an athlete who's good swimming skills and they want to maintain some swimming in their routine, I will schedule their recovery workouts as swimming. It's a great recovery exercise because your heart, your limbs are all on the horizontal. There's maybe a little pressure from the water kind of helping the venous return. It's incredible for recovery, but you have to be a good swimmer and you have to be able to comfortably do laps for whatever 20, 30 minutes at a very low heart rate. And if you're not and that's the place for swimming for mountaineering. The other thing for people to think about is that the closer you get to this is what principle of coaching and training. The closer you get to the event, the more the training needs to look like the event.
The event, yeah.
So if you're 2 years out from Everest and you want to do a bunch of swimming this summer, yeah, knock yourself out. But those last 6 or 8 months before you go to Everest, you're probably not going to be swimming very much if you expect to be fit for climbing Everest or climbing any mountain.
As we kind of begin to wrap up a little bit here, what a mistake do you think people make, or what's the best practices that you see people perform in order to achieve whatever their objective is, of swimming, running, climbing? What's the best practice? And conversely, what do you see people miss often in their preparation, in their training?
The number one thing that people underestimate or miss in their training and their physical training preparation is they don't allow enough runway. They don't allow enough time. It takes more than 12 weeks to get fit to do a big mountaineering objective. And you know, the physiology of this is that for a young, let's say 20 to 30 year old athlete, it takes them about 10 years of consistent training to reach their genetic potential.
Wow.
So if you're thinking about that 12 weeks is really a long time, that you're going to get super fit in 12 weeks, well, you're just going to start to change things in 12 weeks. That's kind of like the minimum. You know, we like to say for coaching that we don't want to work with anyone for less than 16 weeks, 4 months, because we know for a fact that like everyone sees such significant changes in 16 weeks that they're like, oh yeah, this is working and I can see it and I can measure it, more importantly. So there's like no, then by then you've got like complete buy-in with the athlete and they're like, oh yeah, this is totally working. I'm hiking faster. I'm doing more vertical feet per hour and my heart rate is lower and I'm less tired at the end of it. This is clearly working. So, you know, that's the kind of, after about 12 weeks, that really kicks in for people. So I really encourage people to try to give themselves as much time. And there's no amount of time is too long, like even 2 years. We've had people train with us for 2 years to go climb Everest. And I don't think that there's anything wrong with that. Are we going to go through a couple of cycles? Yes. Are we going to absolutely change how your entire body functions in the mountains? You bet we are, because you're going to be a totally different person if you commit to training, you know, 5 to 6 days a week, every week for, you know, 100 weeks. That's going to be massive. So that's the one thing. The other thing that I would say is people underestimate the importance of strength training and they oversimplify it. Strength training is a very excellent tool for a knowledgeable coach or training plan author. It needs to be periodized, meaning that it needs to change it a little bit every 8 weeks or so, depending on the details. And we can use that. And strength training is very well understood. Strength training, it's a little bit like we've had so many lab rats, i.e. athletes, yeah, over the last 100 years of Olympic sport and everything else, that and strength training is such a like kind of input in, output out sort of system, that all the variations have been tried. And so it's quite, you know, when we build strength training plans for endurance athletes, we understand exactly how to do it. And it's not the, I don't know, whatever, sign up for some workout, random, you know, influencers work strength workout that looks really cool and hard on Instagram. You know, that's maybe a good workout and it's maybe good for fun and health and fitness and sharing with your friends and getting fired up and doing as a group or something like that. But, you know, if you really want to utilize strength training as a tool to get better for mountain sports, then there is a very particular path. And I think that's something that isn't super well understood. But I think the other thing that a lot of people do well, a lot of people are out there hiking with weight. I think that that's a good thing. I think that it can be risky if people start too soon. I always tell people they need to have an endurance base and they need to have a strength base before doing that. So, you know, if you're a normally very active person and you're going to go climb Rainier in 8 weeks and you start carrying a pack, yeah, okay, that can work and you can get away with it. And that's nothing bad. I think it's a little oversimplified. I don't think it is oversimplified, but you know, it's something that a lot of people intuitively get right. Like, oh, I have to like climb Rainier and I have to carry a 60-pound pack. I better start carrying a pack. Like, yeah, that's a good idea. That's generally a good idea. Yeah. You know, as long as you're not getting injured and you have a good strength base and, you know, don't have knee problems and those things.
Yeah, right.
You know, the more individualized your circumstances, whether it's injuries or time away from training or anything like that, the more a person benefits from really custom advice from a coach.
Yeah. So you have you're in a unique position of being a climber. I have to work this in that Reinhold Messner, make sure I get this quote correct, that Reinhold Messner called you the best high altitude climber in the world. That's pretty high.
He did, yeah.
That's pretty high cotton. So when you survey let's just stay with mountaineering and as opposed to the other sports, when you survey the world of climbing now, I often call Everest the mountain that people love to hate. You know, I've been told by magazines that if they put Everest on the cover, that'll be their best selling issue of the year. Or most hits.
I believe it.
And also it'll engender the most caustic comments from people. So when you look at it, and you and I both are lovers of the sport. And if 100%. I could put myself in your category for a moment of that, in that element, what do you see in the sport right now? Because there's lots of issues going on with it, with, you know, it's getting to be very expensive to go on some of these climbs. The commercialization, the luxury element of it, the level of support, the, you know, the Instagram driven frenzy to get the summit selfie. What's your take on the sport, and what's your, if you have any concerns looking forward for the sport itself, in terms of how it's going to continue to develop? And then I've got one last question for you.
Yeah, it's a big question. Yeah. You know, people may be surprised, but I actually think all of this is essentially a good signal that the sport is alive, because people are bringing themselves and their, you know, values, whether you want to agree with them or not, they're bringing that to the sport and they're bringing that to the mountains. Now, whether or not, you know, I agree with how people climb the mountains or what their motivations are, you know, honestly, like, I can tell you one thing, none of them care what I think. and that's fine. And yeah, that's fine. And I'm allowed to have my opinion, and I could say like, this is bad or that's good or whatever. And none of them care. And it, my opinion doesn't change anything. And what I can say is that I lived my life of climbing exactly the way I wanted to. I did exactly the kinds of things I wanted to do, and exactly the approach and reflecting the values that I personally hold. And that was my, let's say, story of climbing. I got to paint my picture of how I thought climbing should be, and other people are painting their pictures of how they think climbing should be. And I think that's super healthy. And I think that, you know, at different times, we all have different kind of heroes. You know, I mean, I certainly looked up to a lot of the climbing Reinhold Messner did, but not all of it. And I've met Reinhold a bunch of times and I've talked to him about this, you know, like I, you know, when his early climbs, like when he climbed the RuPaul face in 1970 with his brother, and the first ascents he put up on the Dolomites as a teenager, and that super, like, you know, he was really a purist. And then he kind of was like, he lost his toes and he became this, you know, sometimes derisively called a collector when he wanted to climb all the 14,000 meter peaks. But again, like, nothing wrong with that. Like, he saw an opportunity. He's not a dumb guy. He's a very smart guy. And it was something he was like, yeah, I have the ability. I have the constitution. I have the intelligence. I have the ability to fund this. Like, this is going to be a great way to live my life. And he did it. And, you know, and I really admire him for doing that. And I admire this current generation for the same thing. You know, they're figuring it out. I think I am really grateful that I did not climb during the Instagram generation or Instagram era. Like, social media was basically over, you know, yeah. I didn't exist when I was in my climbing career, which makes me sound super old now, but I'm, you know, 53. I'm old, but I'm not like, you know, a dinosaur quite yet. But that's really, you know, that would not have been healthy for me. I think I would have struggled with that. And I probably just would have, and I'm sure, and I know for a fact there's climbers out there that do this now. I just wouldn't have been on social media.
Yes.
I just wouldn't have participated there. And I would have been fine also if nobody knew about me and nobody cared what I did. That would have also been okay. And I think that I think that so much is changing. One of the things that I have to say that I lament, if you will, is the cost. What you said is the cost. Like, my first expedition to Nanga Parbat in 1990 cost me $800. I mean, we were 18 people together, in part to bring the cost down, but that was the whole cost. It was the plane ticket, it was the permit, it was everything, right? And then, like, when Vince and I climbed Nanga Parbat, our whole trip cost $12,000.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, and 4,000 of that was the permit.
Yeah.
And it was just two guys, right? And we didn't have, you know, we didn't have much support staff. We just had a cook and base camp. At that time, I owned my all my kit, base camp tents and sleeping bags and a base camp kitchen. I went over there so much. I just bought all that stuff and just left it in a storage area there for most of the year. And then I just used them every summer. So I didn't, so I had like, you know, had very limited, you know, additional costs. So, you know, that has changed. And I think that that's a shame because I think the mountains are really about freedom. And I don't, and money is often about controlling people, not always, but often. And I think it certainly limits what people are able to do. And on the big peaks, that said, there's still a infinite number of smaller mountains around the world that are absolutely beautiful and absolutely worthy of adventuring and incredible places to visit and explore, you know, oneself and the environment as well.
So what advice, my last question, what advice would 53-year-old Steve House give to 16-year-old Steve House?
It's a great question. I would just say that you're on the right path. And that even though you can't see it, it was going to work out okay. Because I think I had a lot of angst about that. Like I was really scared about not having enough money, not being able to take care of myself. That I was on the right path for me.
You know, I talk to a lot of young people, and I say young, like under 25. That want to get into the sport. And, you know, a lot of people want to go climb Everest because, you know, it's still the highest mountain in the world.
Sure.
Or they want to do, you know, they want to become you or Alex or Conrad or somebody, some of their heroes. And you used the word earlier in reference to physical training about not having enough runway. And what I see a lot of younger people doing is they want instant gratification. You know, they want to go, it's December and they want to go to Everest in April and they're just, and they don't have any experience. So one of the things that the experience, the wisdom that you passed on to your young self is that be patient, enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
Don't get hung up in the, you know, the ticks, you know, all the check boxes, just go out there
100%. And
enjoy it, climb it. Enjoy the camaraderie of the community, because that's one thing that I think was really, really cool that you talked about, is that you were able to tap into that community, and the community is very generous, very willing to help.
Incredibly generous. Yes.
I mean,
incredible community of people,
sometimes for fee, but mostly for free. And if you're willing to tap into that community, then there's a lot of people out there that are willing to, you know, give you advice and help you and be a mentor. So Steve, congratulations,
you know, when,
where you are.
When people, thank you, Alan. When people ask me that question about that, when you, the patience thing, a story I will tell people is that, you know, I got my first apprentice mountain guide job when I was 20 years old for $45 a day. By the time I was 30, I made $99 per day of before taxes and everything. I was an employee, so all that came out. And I didn't get my first sponsorship until I was 34. And that year I got a pair of crampons and two ice axes. And I didn't make my first money from sponsorship until I was 35. And I'd already climbed the RuPaul base on Nanga Parbat. And it was $1,500.
Oh.
That was how much I made that year from sponsorship. That was the first amount. It got much more over time and eventually got into a low six figure salary. And I was able to live a comfortable middle class life and buy a house and do lots of things I never imagined I would be able to do. But the thing with sponsorship and money around climbing, it all comes after you've done the thing. It doesn't come before you've done the thing. And people need to get that through. All the reward comes. It's very delayed. Yeah. It's very much after. And so you have to go through it if you want to make this a lifestyle or a life, you have to go figure out a way to just support yourself to go through it, because nobody's going to come help you. It's up to you to make that happen. And if there's a reward at the end, great, but don't count on it.
But often the reward is the journey itself. You know, the journey is the destination.
100%. Yeah, yeah. I should have said a financial reward. I should have qualified that.
I don't know any you know, independently wealthy climbers out there that are running hedge funds. So
you know, but interestingly, there are those people out there that you know, I've coached a guy. He runs a hedge fund and lives in Aspen. He climbed Everest in like 1986 or something. You know, he's still mountaineering and still climbing. I mean, you think about Dick Bass, the first guy to do the seven summits. I mean, he was an extremely successful entrepreneur, a very wealthy man, and that was kind of part of what funded that. You know, thing which now. You know, you don't have to be Dick Bass first and run a whole bunch of resorts around the world to actually afford to do the seven summits and make it happen. So, you know, there's those people out there, but that's part of the community. That's so amazing. I mean, I've met three of the 10 wealthiest people in the United States of America, and they all have some connection to climbing.
Cool. I guess I was talking about a dedicated professional climber. That as opposed to
someone
who runs a hedge fund and then they climbing is a passion for them, you know.
Yeah, that's true.
My friend, hey, also I just want to throw a plug in here and thank you for allowing Summit Coach to be an affiliate and to pass on a little discount for people that take advantage of your plans, your programs, your coaching. So honored to be part of that community there. So you guys are doing a great job. I really appreciate you and what you do and the whole team. I've had many clients successfully use your programs, either through coaching or the Training Peaks or whatever it happens to be. And all of them are just very, very happy customers. So well done.
Good. And likewise, we've had a lot of people that you've sent over to us for coaching that are really happy, you know, and you fill a niche that is really important for people to figure out their path, you know, through all of the obstacles that lie between the idea and the realization of climbing a big mountain.
That's what it's all about. All right, man.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks so much, Alan.